Okay, it looks like everyone's in now, so we'll get started. Thank you very much for joining us this morning for the second in the Our Mental Wellness series of webinars that we're running from the Department of Experimental Psychology here at the University of Oxford. My name's Cathy Creswell and I'm delighted to be hosting this session where we're really drawing on the wide expertise that we have across the university for these talks, which are all focused on mental health and well-being, and which we put on really as a reflection of the recognition of the additional stresses that are being faced by many of our staff and students at this difficult time. So as you know, today we'll be hearing about overcoming sleep problems. However, I also wanted to take this opportunity to alert you to the next two upcoming seminars in the series, which are Managing Depression and Low Mood, which will be held on the 19th of November, and Overcoming Mistrust and Paranoia, which will be held on the 20th of January. So please do join us for those if you can. And all of the talks will also be available on our Department of Experimental Psychology YouTube channel. So feel free to go back and rewatch anything there. So today we'll be hearing from three members of our university community, starting with a talk from Professor Colin Espy. And Colin is Professor of Sleep Medicine in the Nuffield Department of Clinical Neuroscience, is a fellow at Somerville College and also a senior research fellow in the University Department of Psychiatry. So thank you ever so much for joining us today, Colin, and I'll hand over to you now.
Thanks very much, Cathy, and hello everyone. And thank you very much for taking this initiative for the university and the local community. I think it's great that at these times we're all looking after our own and each other's mental health. And of course, sleep has a very important part to play in that, as we shall see. So that's my background, my affiliations. By training, I'm a clinical psychologist. I do put up resources from time to time on Twitter, if you want to look those up at Prof. Espy, and also discuss some ongoing research and things. Last week, we were thinking with the Mental Health Foundation about the importance of taking sleep seriously. I was working with them on their campaign that was launched over last weekend. And earlier in the year, Public Health England, as part of their Every Mind Matters campaign, also had a focus on sleep. Sleep seems something that's really central to our health and well-being. And don't we know that during this time of pandemic, sleep has been even more important to us. And we know from a number of international studies that sleep has been badly affected during these times. The isolation and confinement has probably contributed to that, as well as the uncertainty and risk that we're all facing. So there are challenges for all of us. And it shouldn't perhaps really surprise us that that's the case if we think about the central role that sleep plays in our lives. Sleep isn't a nice to have, although it is nice to have sleep. It's actually a need to have. It's one of life's essentials. And if you think about not having good water supply or enough food, or if you think about the symptoms you would have if there was insufficient oxygen, then you would understand that sleep, like these other things, has got concomitant results when we don't get enough sleep, either through sleep deprivation or through having insomnia symptoms. We have a big debt to sleep. These are just some of the things that sleep does for us. It's amazing, actually, what the brain can accomplish without us when we're asleep. There's so much going on. Indeed, it's been suggested by researchers that sleep is actually the brain's preferred state, because we are kind of out the way at that point. And the brain can go on with the work it needs to do in clearing toxic waste, in regenerating cells. You know, rest is not as good as a sleep. You don't regenerate cells during rest, only during sleep. The amino acids, the building blocks of life, are synthesized during sleep. Infection control and immune signaling is heavily dependent on sleep. And of course, for today's talk and for today's theme, sleep is incredibly important for cognitive and emotional functions. The regulation of our emotions is heavily sleep dependent, and memory consolidation is much more likely to occur during sleep than during wakefulness. Our brain is very much smarter than we are, and it makes use of those hours of sleep to do all this important work. We also know that when sleep is connected with mental health, as it often is, that we can actually improve our mental health if we actually improve our sleep. This is a big study. It was led by colleague Dan Freeman in Oxford, demonstrating in a causal way that if you improve sleep when you're having difficulties with insomnia, you will improve also mental health symptoms. And this was a very, very big study. As you can see, 3,755 people were randomized into the trial. This is probably the largest trial ever conducted in the world of cognitive behavioral therapy. Okay, so this is a study that was published by Dan Freeman and his team. And I was just saying that this is a very, very big study demonstrating that sleep is centrally important for our mental health and well-being. And there was another study we conducted even more recently in Oxford showing that if you improve sleep, you can also improve your well-being, your quality of life, a direct relationship, if you like, between sleep and daytime function. And we're designed as 24-hour creatures. You know, sleep and wake and sleep and wake across the life course is crucially important to deliver that rhythm of life and to deliver consciousness even, never mind quality of life. Sleep is something that is an essential thing. We can't do without it. But sleep is not really a thing. Sleep is actually a very complex process. And I wouldn't even try too much to absorb the detail on this on this slide. But it is there to show you, and this is non-REM sleep. This is so orthodox sleep that makes up about 75% of your night, non-dreeping sleep, if you like. You can see there's lots of different elements to it. And the part at the bottom here, this is deep sleep, but that only makes up maybe 15, 20% of your night. Most of your night is spent in light sleep, either stage two sleep or dreaming sleep. And dreaming sleep is remarkable thing because during dreaming sleep, you're actually paralyzed, you're functionally paralyzed. So when you see your dog lying there and you say to your partner, oh, look, he's chasing rabbits, because he's you know, making occasional twitches like you see down here, but actually he's flatlining here because the muscle activity is actually gone and the dog is paralyzed, although the eyeballs may be moving, just like we do in dreaming sleep. So you're actually paralyzed during sleep and you've got a very active brain. It's a fascinating phenomenon. And all of these elements of sleep really seem to be important to serve all the different functions that we depend upon. I asked a couple of scientific colleagues from Ireland to help us to really understand how sleep is regulated. So I'm going to share a little video with you from them. And here they are here. You maybe recognize them. Of course, it's Father Ted and Dougal. Yeah, so it's interesting, isn't it? Here we have Father Ted. Doesn't he so much deserve to sleep? He's trying his best. And Dougal seems to have accidentally fallen asleep. And there's an important truth in this. It is central to how sleep is regulated, that sleep is not a voluntary process. Just like breathing, you don't choose to breathe. You don't breathe well when you choose to breathe. If you focus on your breathing, you'll become more anxious. Sleep is something that happens to us. It's regulated by our sleep drive. It's after 10 in the morning. If you got up around 7 this morning, you're 3 hours into sleep deprivation now. By the time you get to the evening, 10 o'clock tonight, you'll be 15 hours into sleep deprivation. And your sleep deprivation will be paid. The sleep debt will be paid by the sleep banker overnight. Okay? But there's another wonderful aspect to this, because if it was only a case of that buildup of sleep debt over the day, we'd get progressively less and less able to function across the day. You maybe feel that you do that already, but you probably don't, because there's a system called the circadian system that alerts us and keeps us alert during the day and holds back the pressure of the buildup of the homeostatic drive for sleep the day and releases us into sleep at night. And what you saw with Dougal there was that he had perfect timing, maybe perfect comic timing, but perfect timing for his sleep. He fell asleep. The sleep gate opened, the sleep debt was being repaid, the circadian clock had said, go to sleep, and he fell asleep. Maybe that was the same for Father Ted, but what he finds is his psychology can get in the way. His psychology can get in the way. And that's why psychology can help sleep problems, because we can overcome that kind of problem that Father Ted describes. And we've all experienced it, haven't we? Feeling exhausted, so much wanting to sleep, but unable to sleep. So what is sleep and why does it matter? Well, what we're learning is that sleep is one of life's absolute essentials. It's essential for physical and mental health, as I've been saying, throughout our lives, from the moment we're born right through to our late life. It's not a thing. It's intriguingly complex, of different stages and phases, and all of these pieces are important to deliver the functions that sleep serves. And sleep is regulated by this drive function by the body clock, but our psychology can get in the way, or it can help. Sleep is something that you need to allow to happen. You can't make it happen. So how can we look after our sleep, and how can we solve the tricky sleep problems that we all have from time to time, not least at the moment? Well, I'm going to suggest just a few things, and we can discuss more of them together afterwards. One thing is, think about how much sleep you actually need. Become a sleep scientist for a while. Now, I often suggest to people that it'd be good to go to a shoe shop when you're trying to figure out how much sleep you need. Because when you go to a shoe shop, you're met with different sizes of shoe. And you're not at all surprised that there should be different sizes. And because you've got to figure out which one's going to fit you. But isn't it interesting where sleep is concerned that we often think, how much sleep should I get? It's almost saying, what size of shoe should I have? That doesn't make any sense at all. There's going to be a range of shoe sizes that will fit an adult, but there's going to be a range. You've got to figure out what fits. You've got to figure out how much sleep you actually need. And many, many people don't actually do that and still haven't done that. They just go to bed by convention at a certain time because there's nothing else to do, or because a partner's going to bed, get up at a certain time because of work. Never really thought about how much sleep you need. And yet you know the answer to learning. The primary way in which we learn is not by being taught. The primary way we learn is by trial and error. That's how we learn stuff. You know, like this little baby. Oh, where does this red block go? Oh, it doesn't go in the round hole. It goes in the square hole because I've tried it in all of them and I've figured out that's the one it goes in. So figure it out, practice, experiment with different lengths of sleep as well as different timings of sleep. Keep some data, maybe not as much of that, but don't be concerned about too much clock watching and all that business. Trust yourself to figure it out. Babies can do it, you can do it. And then consider yourself, are you somewhat a night owl, or are you a bit more of a morning person? Maybe during COVID, during lockdown particularly, we were all becoming a little bit more of a night owl, perhaps going to bed a bit later and getting up a bit later. We're all becoming like teenagers again, perhaps. Maybe we're back at work again. But this is not just a figure of speech, this kind of idea of the body clock and the timing of things. It's also part of us. And there are some people who are night owls by nature. That means they don't actually feel sleepy till late, and they don't feel alert until later in the morning or even into the afternoon in some cases if it's very extreme. And there are also people who are natural morning people who are not the life and soul of the party perhaps, but they tend to feel kind of sleepy about 8 and want to go to bed at 9 and then wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning ready for the day. So there are these clock types as well. But there are also people who are neither owls nor larks. And that's most people. But when you're thinking about experimenting with your sleep, just think about what clock type you might be. And therefore, that might help you discover which owl in the shoe shop to go to in the first place. Okay, insomnia is where it gets a little bit more tricky. This is a persistent problem affecting 20% of the population on a regular basis, 10% of the population at a clinical level. And the approaches that help with insomnia come from the cognitive behavioral therapeutics toolbox. I've trying to stop using the term CBT because people think CBT is a treatment. CBT is a methodology of treatment. It includes, I think the American Psychological Association suggests something like 1,200 different intervention methods. So here are some of the ones that have been useful and evidence-based for insomnia. Some are behavioral, like stimulus control therapy, which I'm going to mention a little bit, or restricting your sleep time in bed to consolidate your sleep. Some are more mental, cognitive, as the CBT suggests, as a C element to that. Things like cognitive control, restructuring, paradoxical intention. There are some relaxation methods at work. Sleep hygiene education is not drinking too much coffee and that kind of thing. which is not really in itself a particularly effective treatment for insomnia, but it's a good thing to look after your hygiene, your lifestyle, and have a bedroom environment that's conducive to sleep. So I'm going to give you three examples of techniques that you could use that I think would be helpful. This is the first one. It's a link, right? There's a chain, it's a connection. What is your connection between bed and sleep? Dougal went to bed, fell asleep. Everything was aligned. He was sleepy at that point. The circadian gate was opening. He fell asleep. He's likely to then associate his bed with sleep and find that this is a place that I go to bed, bed, sleep. Think bed, think sleep. When we settle a youngster in bed and we get them used to being in bed, they know to settle in that bedroom. And then that settling in that room without you there, those connections are built, they fall asleep naturally. We don't put them to bed asleep. We put them to bed so they feel comfortable there and then they fall asleep. And it's all chained together. That's what we need to try and achieve again if our sleep has become broken. One of the best ways to do that is what I call the quarter of an hour rule. Don't spend too long lying awake in bed. I don't know what quarter of an hour is, but it's certainly not 15 minutes. Quarter of an hour is long enough, and you'll know it. How long have I been speaking? 10 minutes? Probably about that. So you're able to judge time. You've been doing it for a long time. You don't need a clock. You don't need a watch in bed. Give yourself enough time. And if you can't sleep, get up and do something else. Go back to bed. Reconnect with your bed when you feel sleepy. This is a piece of rope or a piece of string with frayed edges. And I use this to illustrate, don't go to bed with loose ends. Not talking about your split ends, I'm talking about loose ends, right? Tie them off before you go to bed. Spend a bit of time putting the day to rest. Don't expect to, because you're so important and busy and productive, and you've been working so hard that you now deserve to fall asleep, and it's not fair because you're not. You can't just go off that cliff very easily. Try to wind down and spend a bit of time just putting the day to rest. Rehearsing a little bit, how did today go? What happened? Are there any loose ends from that? And planning ahead, what have I got ready? What am I doing the next day? And do that before you go to bed. Put the day to rest. And this is a tribute to my granny, who knitted jumpers all the time. And then she re-knitted them again and re-knitted them again using the same wool. And you know what? Every time she used the wool again, the jumper became nice and tight again. Because before then, it got all saggy, right? Because it'd been used and pulled over and, you know, and you know what kids do with the cuffs of your jumpers and they pull it all out of shape. But she was able to re-knit that wool again. Admittedly, the next time I got the jumper, it had a band of a different colour on it because I'd now got bigger. But the point is, you can tear your sleep into that content and knit it back in together tightly again. And the way you do that is by actually spending a little bit less time in bed to try and tighten up your sleep pattern and sleep through a shorter window. So you're then able to stretch it again and get back to the shape you want it to be in. So these are some examples of CBT. There's a CBT program that you can access in Oxford and the Thames Valley area that we've developed. It's a no cost. It's called Sleepio. You can go to sleepio.com and access this because we did a big study recently with Oxford Academic Health Sciences Network funded by Innovate UK. And you can go to their website and read that report as well, if you like. But just to give you a little flavor of what Sleepio would look like and how it might help you, let me introduce another prof.
Hello there, Martin. Welcome to Sleepio. I am the prof, and I'm here to do everything I can to help you sleep better. Now, you may be thinking, why should I trust you to tell me what to do? Onto nicotine, the drug found in cigarettes and other tobacco products.
So what the program does, it takes you through six sessions over 6 weeks. It starts with things like sleep hygiene, and then later on, it goes on to things that are more based on CBT techniques. Let me just find one of those, let me see what that looks like.
Sleep prof. No matter what I do, I can't get to sleep at night. I don't know what's wrong with me. I just lie there, wide awake, getting frustrated. It's driving me mad. I'm sick of it, Prof.
Now, what advice should I give him?
So the program tailors these mental techniques to the problems that you're having with your racing mind. And they could be individual to you, and the program will suggest and take you through things that you can practice on your own. So these are ways in which you can look after those tricky sleep problems. Establish your personalized sleep pattern using trial and error, the best learning method known to man. Trust your sleep. Be like Dougal. Use behavioral strategies to strengthen your bed-sleep connection, like you would do with your kids. Get it into a pattern. Trust yourself to do it. Use cognitive strategies to manage your mental arousal, because that gets in the way. That's the psychology that gets in the way. And learn to sleep like you walk, like you talk, like you breathe, without thinking about it. That's my recommendations for how to overcome sleep problems.
Great. Thank you ever so much, Colin. I'm sure people found that extremely helpful. And actually, many of the things that people asked about when they submitted questions did relate to many of the issues that you spoke about. So it'll be great now to talk a little bit more about those. So before we start, I'd like to introduce our fellow panel members. So really pleased that we're also joined today by Dr. Felicity Waite and Dr. Dmitry Gavrilov. And so Felicity is also a clinical psychologist and a Wellcome Trust Clinical Fellow, as well as a research fellow at Lineker College and deputy lead of the Oxford Cognitive Approaches to Psychosis Group in the Department of Psychiatry. And of particular relevance to today, Felicity is leading a novel intervention study to address sleep problems among young people at risk of psychosis. And Dmitry is another clinical psychologist. He's clinical course tutor in sleep medicine in the Sleep and Circadian Neuroscience Institute in the Nuffield Department of Clinical Neurosciences, and is a senior clinical psychologist at the John Radcliffe Hospital. So thank you ever so much for joining us today. And so going to the questions that were submitted, many people who got in touch referred to difficulties with getting to sleep. So this very much picks up on the issues that you've highlighted, Colin, and the difficulties that Father Ted was having there. People particularly talked about how hard it was after a busy day when there'd been a lot of screen time in the midst of a never-ending to-do list. So I guess where there are lots of loose ends there. So it'd be great to hear from the panel what you would recommend people do to help them turn off their busy minds and to help them get to sleep more easily. So we've heard some great tips on that already from Colin. It'd be great to also hear your thoughts. If I go to you, Dmitry, first.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy. This is I think this is really, really important. And the question is one that I think probably we're all familiar with in terms of our experiences. We'll all have experienced a poor night's sleep in this kind of way, having had lots to get on with. One of the most important things I think that Colin alluded to earlier is what I like to call sort of sleep stopping distance, thinking about, if you're in a car, braking and stopping immediately causes a real mess for everyone. But if you think about sleep in a similar way, we decelerate gradually towards sleep. Switching off the day and then jumping into bed is probably unlikely to be particularly helpful. And there's this odd narrative societally that all you've got to do is retire yourself out. Be really busy, do lots, run around, maybe go for a jog, get really, really tired and really, really exhausted, and somehow you'll fall asleep. And actually, a lot of that activity is very alerting activity, is stuff that can keep you going and cause you to feel even more stimulated. So doing things that help you relax, unsurprisingly, can be helpful ways to get you to sleep. But these aren't things that help you feel sleepy. They're things that help take away the arousal, take away the anxiety, the frustration that masks the sleepiness that sits just behind the curtain that very often we can't see. So things like, even things like having a bath, just saying, listen, I'm not going to look at my emails for 2 hours before bed. I'm going to have my time to watch that documentary that I've really wanted to watch or read that book that I've really wanted to read. Doing things like this, they don't pertain to sleep. They're not about trying to get to sleep. They're about trying to relax and having a pleasant evening. And in doing so, as I say, you allow the sleepiness that's there to kind of say eventually, do you know what, actually, it's probably time to head to bed. And then you recognize the sleepiness and you head to bed, just as Dougal did earlier.
Great. Thanks so much, Dmitry. Felicity, would you like to add anything in relation to getting to sleep?
Thank you, and thanks, Colin, for a great talk there as well. Colin mentioned about this idea of tying up the loose ends, and I think this can be really important when we've had a very busy day, and it can actually situate itself right at the end of our working day, so that way before we're even thinking about bedtime, we have the chance to kind of put the day to rest, to pull everything together, set our to-do the next day, and then go down and make that transition between work or the busyness of the day, and then a separate period of kind of relaxing and rejuvenating. And that's been particularly important, I think, for those of us who've been home working, where perhaps those usual transitions between work and relaxation have been disrupted. And so putting those the end of the day as a real distinct marker, and then being able to move into those relaxing activities. And the last thing I would just add is that it's really important for our bodies to have rhythm. So having that wind down routine that Dimitri was describing, where we're moving through those relaxing activities, allows our body to kind of prepare itself to expect sleep next. We can't force sleep, we can't make it happen, but we can set the scene for sleep to occur naturally. And so having a regular routine will really help that. And it will mean that you're hitting that top kind of sleep pressure in a relaxed way, just at that moment aligned with your body clock.
Great, thank you very much. So in addition to trouble getting to sleep, another common issue that was raised related to staying asleep. So many people are asked about what they can do to help themselves to get back to sleep when they work in the, when they wake in the night or in the early hours. And the tendency for this to have come on with age and or hormonal changes was often mentioned in the questions. So it would be interesting to hear your thoughts on that as well. So Felicity, if I come back to you first of all.
Great. Of course, Colin was saying that sleep is this kind of fascinating experience. It's not one thing that happens. Actually, sorry, we're moving through different phases of types of sleep in a particular predictable cycle. So we move through many different sleep cycles throughout the night, and each one lasts around 60 to 90 minutes. And at the end of each sleep cycle, we have this momentary waking. And so for most of us, if we're able to kind of just drift straight back off to sleep, and we may not have noticed that we've even woken in the night. The people that have raised this question, it sounds like those wakings become very pertinent, and that can be for a few reasons. One, of course, is that the more we've got going on in our mind, the busier we are, the more alert we are, then that very minor waking can really get our mind just enough space to let all those worries be flooding back in, or thoughts about the next day, or the to-do list, or all those things that are going through our mind. And so that kind of wind down routine to reduce any hyperarousal, being on edge before bed, can really help to mean that we're much more calm throughout the night. And then the other thing is about building up our sleep pressure. So this is our propensity or need to sleep. And we were saying earlier that this increases with the amount of time that we're awake. Now, if you go to bed and you're kind of tired, but not really tired, it's a bit like setting off on a car journey with the petrol tank half full. You can set off on that journey and you'll get part of the way there, but you might not reach your destination. So what we want to do is really increase the sleep pressure so that we're really building that up and we're ready to fall off to sleep and then stay asleep throughout the night. That's the aim for that one.
Great, thank you very much. And Colin, was there anything you'd like to add in relation to getting back to sleep?
Yeah, I think one of the approaches that we use in clinical psychology is called reframing, cognitive reframing. So I think let's just think about a 7 or 8 hour stretch, or a 6, 7, 8 hour stretch, whatever it is. During the day, is there a 6 or 7, 8 hour period when you're totally concentrating, when you're totally on things, when you're totally, you know, at your peak? I think if we expect our sleep to be just this consolidated period of peak sleep, you know, and we are kind of unaware of anything, it's just not a realistic prospect. But we kind of beat ourselves up about it when we find that our sleep is broken. As Felicity was saying, our sleep is always broken. You know, it's just that you don't realize it most of the time. That regular, the cadence of sleep leads to these fracture points. But there's also lots and lots of micro arousals. When you turn in bed, your partner moves. It has a micro arousal. You know, when we hear a noise outside, there's a reaction in the brain to that because we heard it. You hear things whether or not you know you've heard them. You see things. You can see during your sleep if you're sleepwalking. And yet, you know, people, how can you see when you're sleeping? I think we've got a very naive idea about what sleep is, and we overthink it, and it's that overthinking of it that leads to this concern about, oh, I'm awake, I'm not going to go back to sleep, what's going to happen now? Rather than thinking, well, that's all right. What would you do during the day if you were finding it difficult to concentrate? You take a break for 10, 15 minutes and you do it again. You just pick up again. And I think if we can take that kind of approach, as well as tightening your sleep up a little bit, not having too long in bed, because if you take my grandma's jumper, if you stretch it out, it's going to create holes. Right? If we try to sleep for too long, when we're worried about sleep, that's the wrong thing to do. We should be trying to tighten it up. So I think that bigger picture of understanding that, ah, maybe it's okay actually that you would have time of being awake during the night, and you're awake for 10 minutes and you go back to sleep again. I think that would help a lot if people didn't overthink it. And if you take that approach, you're probably more likely to fall asleep quickly anyway.
Great, thanks very much. So although many people felt they were struggling with not getting enough sleep, others got in touch because they were concerned about getting too much sleep. Is there an ideal amount of sleep, and can we get too much? So Dimitri, maybe I could go to you first of all.
Thanks, Kathy. This is a really interesting question. We often think about sleep problems as being very much related to not getting enough sleep, but sleep problems can be really varied. And when we talk clinically about sleep disorders, we talk about a really broad range of problems people have with their sleep, one of which is getting too much sleep, or sleep happening in a sort of an uncontrolled way. And I'll focus on sort of more normative examples of things rather than going down that route. But certainly, I suppose the first thing to bear in mind is if you're finding that you're needing more sleep, that might be to do with lots of different things. One of which might be the fact that you're not getting enough sleep at the time in which you're supposed to be getting it, that it would be ideal to get. Another reason that I think we might get caught up in this sort of idea of feeling lethargic or sleepy is because we might not be doing enough activity, might not being as active as we'd like to be. This is something that I've seen an awful lot of during lockdown, and certainly over the COVID pandemic. People are unable to get out and do as much as they used to do. They're not as stimulated as they used to be. And what you notice is that maybe we're spending more time inside, we're maybe not getting as much sunlight. One thing that's really important for the rhythmicity of the circadian system is sunlight, is daily light exposure. So getting outside every morning and getting the sun that hits the back of the eye, sends the message to the master clock and gets the clock entrained every morning. If that's not happening in a regular way, if that's happening in an irregular way, if the sunlight isn't particularly bright that day and you're spending a lot of time inside, then maybe that lethargy makes you feel like you're more sleepy. It's not necessarily sleepiness. It's just the fact that there's not that much alertness. So I think in terms of being practical, daily activity, getting out and doing plenty, good exercise, all the good stuff that we hear about from all other areas of health. This is important for sleep too. Dynamic daytime activity is a good predictor of good health, good healthy sleep at night. Getting regular light exposure in the morning is a good way to banish lethargy and drowsiness that people might otherwise feel. And if you notice that you're sleepy during the day, then make sure you're getting enough sleep at night, because the most common reason why we experience sleepiness during the day is something we label insufficient sleep syndrome, which is really just this idea that we're not getting enough sleep because we cut our sleep. So one of the things we might do is we say, I'll stay up and watch another half an hour of Bake Off because I want to see the end of the program, even though our body's saying, right, it's sleep time now, off to bed. And we're going, yeah, it's fine. It's only half an hour. But that half an hour multiplied by 5 days, maybe it's not Bake Off every night, but five, you know, that's 2.5 hours less sleep a week. That's a lot. So the point is, if that's happening, and a good indicator that might be happening is sleepiness during the day, but also a long lie-in on the weekends. If you notice that you're binging on the weekends and catching up all that sleep on the weekends, well, why do you need to catch that up? It's because you're not getting enough during the week. So it's worth just having a kind of a review with yourself about why you might be feeling sleepy. And of course, if it's something else, then maybe going and seeing your GP is also a good idea if you feel that you're sleeping a lot.
Great, thank you very much. Colin, is there anything you'd like to add in relation to this issue of sleeping too much?
Yes, I think Dimitri covered a lot of the things that, I mean, and to Dimitri's last point, know your own body, know yourself. If something has changed dramatically and you don't feel well, then you shouldn't ignore it, and you should get it investigated, ask questions and seek some help. But equally, you shouldn't ignore it and not do the obvious things, like, well, maybe I'm not getting enough sleep at other times. Or maybe I'm drinking too much during lockdown, or maybe I've got this thing that Dimitri referred to. It's sometimes called social jet lag. You could look that term up, where people are actually over the course of the week getting enough sleep, but they're binging on it at the weekends and running on empty during the course of the week. So do obvious things first. I think some of the things I said too earlier about experimenting with your sleep pattern. Don't be frightened to experiment with it to try and get it better. And you'll know from your own data, by knowing your own body, you know, whether or not you're feeling better. And differentiate fatigue from sleepiness. Fatigue people don't fall asleep. Fatigue people feel tired. Fatigue and sleepiness are only partly correlated. They're different kinds of things. So differentiate those two. And the best solution to fatigue is activation. Doing things.
Thanks very much. So in addition to questions about being asleep versus being awake, we also had a number of questions about particular experiences people have when they're asleep. So lucid dreams or nightmares, sleepwalking or talking, and what people might be able to do if these are causing disturbance or distress. So Felicity, it would be great to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah, just picking up about dreams and nightmares. These can really leave their mark on us. Whenever we've woken up, perhaps from a particularly intense dream or nightmare, we really feel the emotional effects of that. We kind of feel those emotions very intensely that have come from that nightmare. And we can notice this kind of hanging over into the next day. We might find that we're kind of cross with somebody if they've done something in our dream, and we're kind of annoyed with them, and even though we know it didn't happen, we kind of have that same intensity of the emotional reaction. And that's kind of related to the intense imagery that we're experiencing when we're having these dreams or nightmares. And not only do these nightmares have a knock-on effect on the next day, but often the content can reflect some of the worries or thoughts or concerns that have happened the day before or might be going on at that moment in life. And so thinking about what we can do about these, really, the first is, how do we reduce the likelihood that we're going to have nightmares or intense dreams? And this comes back to creating a kind of calm and safe environment before we go off to sleep. We need to feel safe and we need to feel calm before our body will allow us that experience of sleep. And so we want to think about bringing a kind of down any of that sense of high levels of arousal or worry before sleep. So relaxation and that calming wind down routine before bed. And then if dreams or distressing nightmares do occur in the night, the first step is really just to reground ourselves into the present moment, to recognize that the dream is over, that it's not real, and that we're back in this present moment and we're safe enough. And if you tend to have distressing dreams or nightmares very often, you might want to leave a note for yourself by the bed, a kind of message from your daytime self, so that on waking, you can have that cue to remember that it's okay, even though it felt very intense and you've woken from this nightmare, actually you're safe enough and the dream is over. If you tend to have repetitive content, so you're having the same kind of nightmare, the same story seems to play out night after night, then there is an approach called imagery rescripting, in which you can actually change what happens in the nightmare or dream. And you can kind of, almost like a movie director, you can rewrite the ending. And this means that you can change the meaning and the emotions that go with it. So you might, if you have a distressing dream, you might change it so it has a funny ending, so that any attacker, instead of reaching you, actually slips up on a banana skin or something. And so you can kind of take the heat out of it or the sting out of the nightmare. So those are just a few ideas with responding to those kinds of dreams and nightmares.
Thank you very much. Dimitri, would you like to add anything?
So you also asked, Kathy, about sleepwalking and things like that. So these are quite distinct from what we call REM-related activities. So nightmares are things that happen during REM sleep. This is the emotion processing piece. This is where we're having emotional narrative dreams. Sleepwalking, sleep talking, and things like night terrors, which are very common in young children. These are what we call non-REM arousals or non-REM partial arousals, incomplete arousals, where the brain sort of is, if you like, half asleep, half awake. It's a very crude way of explaining it. But you see that, as Colin mentioned earlier, you can get people that do very intricate, very complex activities whilst asleep. So there's case examples I'm aware of people riding motorcycles in their sleep, which is just particularly extreme. But there are, you know, the more common stuff is walking around or sometimes calling out. Now that happens in the transition from what we call slow wave sleep, the deep sleep we get at the beginning of the night, the deep restorative sleep we get at the beginning of the night to lighter sleep stages, or from those lighter sleep stages into deep sleep. And that transition isn't happening as smoothly as it might otherwise happen. And so you get these unusual things happening. Very often they're benign sort of things that happen. We call them parasomnias in the jargon, but they're not a problem necessarily. If they're happening very frequently and they are beginning to interrupt your sleep or interrupt the sleep of those around you, for example, if you have a young child that's having a night terror that happens very frequently, often the best thing to do is to think about what's making these things happen in terms of their severity or their frequency. And there's two things primarily that increase the severity and frequency of these episodes at night, and one is being sleep deprived and the other one is high levels of arousal before bed. And so these two things are good areas to think about. The first one is that young person, if it's a child who's having lots of night terrors, are they getting enough sleep? Are they sleep deprived? Are they very agitated or worried about things before bed? Or have they got things on their mind before bed that might be causing them to maybe inadvertently causing them to be awake for longer in there, or being unsettled. These things are, they're very common, and they're not a problem per se, but when they do start to interrupt sleep or start to get in the way of other people's sleep, then doing something about them is often about thinking about what might be keeping them going.
So lots of children and young people struggle with falling asleep and staying asleep. And by and large, these experiences of difficulty falling asleep and staying asleep can be considered kind of normative developmental learnings. These are times when children learn to fall asleep independently. We think about things from an evolutionary perspective. We didn't put our children to sleep in the cave next door. They slept around the fire with us and we all huddled down. So actually part of this is a kind of a facet of us living in a modern age. But one of the things that's important to bear in mind is that when someone falls asleep, when a child falls asleep, they do so in a context. And that context is one that for which they have behavioral associations often present. So things like having a parent or a caregiver in the room with them will mean that's how they learn to fall asleep, by having that stimulus there with them. So when they wake up subsequently in the middle of the night, as we all do, and as is normal in sleep at various points in the night, they might then require their parent or caregiver to be there again to resettle them. And if you notice that's happening, or if that's an issue, then one of the most important things is to start helping that child fall asleep independently to begin with, because once they know how to fall asleep independently at the beginning of the night, then they'll be much more likely to sleep through the night and to reinitiate sleep effectively. And there can be lots of reasons, other reasons why children might struggle to fall asleep. But another one that's worth mentioning is that as we grow, as we get older, our sleep timings change too. And so although we think of bedtimes as being primarily a societal construct, actually there's a biological underpinning to this. So the body clock starts to get later and later as we get into older childhood, sorry, and into adolescence. And you may find that actually sometimes a bedtime that has always been that child's bedtime is now out of date, if you like. It's a little bit too early. And so they may get into bed and they may be trying for sleep, but their body clock may be saying, do you know what, we're not quite ready for sleep yet. And then the fact that they can't get to sleep may then frustrate or irritate them, or make it obvious to them that they're unable to fall asleep, which may then induce a bit of anxiety or arousal, which may keep them up even in later. So getting the bedtime right is also really important.
I'd add to that, Dimitri, that for teenagers, it really is the key. As you say, that body clock shifts, so they're not feeling tired or sleepy, they're not ready for bed until much later. But of course, school still starts at the same time, so there's this squeeze on their sleep, which means often teenagers are getting much less sleep than they actually need. So one thing is to try and get on the same page as a whole family, and that can mean renegotiating what bedtime means. In fact, many teenagers may need to go to bed far after you do. And so being on the same page with that and agreeing it with the young person, with siblings, and feeling confident and having a plan for that young person to get themselves to bed at a time when they're going to be able to fall off to sleep more naturally aligned with that body clock. So kind of creating as a family a bit of a sleep team that everyone can kind of work together towards getting the young person sleeping kind of through the night and at the time that suits. The other kind of thing I'd just raise about the bedroom environment is that for many teenagers, their bedroom is the only private place that they have. It's often the place where they're on their phone or laptop or socialising with friends and connecting online. But it's also often the place where people are studying or just taking a bit of downtime. And that can mean that actually the bedroom becomes associated with all sorts of other activities and not just with restful sleep. And as we've been saying today, it's really important for young people to be able to associate bed with sleep. So one thing that might be helpful is having another space, if possible, for young people to be doing their study or work, so that the bedroom can be saved just for kind of sleep. And particularly if that's not possible, only using the bed, laying down on the bed at night time, so that's associated with sleep. And if you are in your bedroom in the day or even the evening, sitting up and making sure there's a distinction and kind of trying not to be on the bed if at all possible. And the last thing I think is that many of us love a lie-in on the weekends, and that's particularly true for teenagers, often because they've had a kind of build-up of need for sleep. They've been saving that a whole week because it's been squeezed throughout the week. But actually that can make Monday morning even harder. So trying to stick with a routine every day of the week, even on the weekend. So maybe a short lie-in, but nothing too long that might disrupt that regular pattern.
So that does bring us up to the end of our allotted time. So I just wanted to take this opportunity to just remind you all again about the next session in our series, which is on managing depression and low mood on the 19th of November. And of course, I'd like to say a huge thank you to our speakers for joining us today. I think it's been such an interesting and hopefully very useful, very practical talk, and clearly extremely timely. I mean, I imagine it always is. So thank you ever so much for giving us your time this morning. We really appreciate it. And I'd also just like to say a final thank you to Hallie, Nicola and Kaya for all their excellent organisation that's enabled this series to be such a success. And of course, thank you all very much for joining us. So goodbye.